Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, December 12th. With the discovery of avian influenza in a wastewater sample in Hilo this week, scientists are on alert. Today we hear from a researcher about efforts in place to protect our native monk seals. How worried should we be? And first, The Atlantic Magazine is featuring a piece about Hawaii and sovereignty that is available to read in the Hawaiian language. And we hanaho a recent interview with designer Manaoliap about his hand in the costuming for Cirque du Soleil's Waikiki show, Awana. It is day three of our end-of-the-year membership campaign. All this week, we have been taking a closer look at the possible impact of avian flu on our native birds. Today, we look at what scientists are doing to monitor what risks there are to our marine mammals, in particular, our native Hawaiian monk seals. Across the globe, there have been die-offs due to the avian influenza. In South America, more than 3,000 sea lions and seals have been casualties. We talked to Michelle Barbieri, who leads the Hawaiian monk seal research program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Up until last month, Hawaii was the last state to be free from avian flu.
We are very familiar with thinking about disease outbreaks for monk seals. We have had a disease outbreak plan for morbillivirus for quite a while. And so that has been the foundation of our preparedness for avian influenza. Granted, there are certainly some differences, but our efforts right now are focused heavily on monitoring through the community and through partners throughout the state to really focus on early detection of any signs of avian influenza in our monk seals, because that's going to be absolutely essential for us to have any chance to mitigate spread through the rest of the population. We have not detected it in any monk seals. Thankfully, all of our monk seals are, you know, out doing their monk seal thing. So we're really glad that we are not seeing that right now. There are a few things that I think give us some hope in this situation for monk seals. Some of those include the fact that, unlike places in the world that folks may have heard about in the news, where there have been large die-offs of seals in, for example, South America, we are fortunate in a sense that the life history and biology of the Hawaiian monk seal is quite a bit different. And they do not have seasonal timing where very, very large numbers of seals all come together in small spaces all at the same time. So because Hawaiian monk seals tend to be a lot more spread out and can reproduce throughout the year, we don't have those big aggregations. So that's definitely something that's kind of built in to the species, probably going to be protective. It's probably not necessarily going to be absolutely protective, but it is definitely a good thing. One of the other things is that this virus lives much longer in the environment in cold, wet environments. And so we do have sunlight and temperature kind of working in our favor.
Well, I know several years back when we were seeing the headlines in the news and it just started, I asked some biologists, you know, do we have to be concerned about our golden plovers, you know, bringing it across or any of the other migratory birds? And they just said, well, you know, chances are if they're sick birds, they may not make it across, and that the chances were low that it would get this far. But still, to know that we've just had now our first case, you know, in this past month, and now we don't know the snapshot there in Hilo, since this just happened with the positive case in the wastewater. You know, I know we're concerned for the nene over there on the Big Island, as well as the other water birds, you know, on the other islands. But I mean, those are positive things, which you said, where our monk seals don't all hang out together at one time.
Yeah, it is. And it, you know, we're still concerned, especially, you know, in parts of the archipelago where we don't have as much real-time surveillance, like in Papahanao, Mokuakea. We do have a lot more monk seals that live there. They're definitely coming in contact with one another, and there are a lot more seabirds there. So, you know, that is something that we're concerned about. And I think, just as you said too, you know, the front lines right now are all of the hardworking folks that are focused on the bird effort, surveillance in birds, detection in birds, and wastewater. And, you know, I really want to give kudos to all those people that are working really hard to provide information and to give us this information, because it very much plays into our overall risk assessment for not just birds and wild birds, but also, you know, how that plays out with monk seals. So I think I think on the whole, we've got, you know, evidence that it reached Hawaii. And we're kind of in that period of time where we're going to be paying very careful attention to see which direction this goes and where it takes us. And meanwhile, using this time to be as prepared as we can.
Well, I understand, you know, when this thing first hit and I was putting calls out that a lot of the monk seal experts were attending a conference in Australia. Were there conversations at that conference when the news broke about the first detection here?
Yes, in the sense that I was one of the people there, and we were definitely talking in between conference sessions about the news. The conference ended before things had really been fully confirmed. And I will say that, yeah, talking with our Australian colleagues out there, they were also thinking about avian influenza preparedness quite heavily. I think more approached it as an inevitability, perhaps. But I think that this little hope that some of these places in the Pacific would be protected is definitely dwindling now.
Yeah, so not a question of if, but when.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so is there any message that you want to give to our listeners out there, you know, whether they're out on the shorelines and maybe see a monk seal that might be ailing? What's the best advice?
Yes, yes. And there is a very robust public sighting network, and we really appreciate the public reporting any sighting of marine mammals and monk seals on the beach, whether there's something concerning or not. So report all sightings of monk seals is the quick and easy answer. And that number is 1-888-256-9840. And that information goes into population monitoring, health monitoring, outreach, not to mention the fact that if there is anything unusual or we happen to be looking for an individual seal for a particular purpose, then that gives us a really quick heads up that there's something we can go check out. And I think also zooming out from monk seals just a little bit, I did want to just reinforce the importance of our communities who are interacting with any birds, whether through agriculture or in other ways. There's some wonderful guidance provided by the USDA called Defend the Flock, and there's a wealth of resources there on biosecurity and protecting your animals in the terrestrial environment. And that's definitely something that folks in the community can really do to help protect their own birds and minimize spread. And really, on the whole, I think this is a community effort in the sense that even just avoiding anything that you might do to facilitate birds aggregating together, like just feeding birds, is something that can bring wild and domestic birds together. And at this point in time, avoiding those kinds of things and being really conservative about that is going to be very helpful. And if we can potentially stem this from having severe impacts in the terrestrial and avian space, I think it will ultimately prove to be beneficial for our marine wildlife as well.
Well, I think we are watching this jump species, right? Birds, cattle, humans. You know, you just wonder what will happen, you know, if you see it in the feral pigs, you know, and then getting into our monk seal population, you know, when we have dwindling numbers and we want, and so much effort has gone into keeping our monk seals healthy that you don't want anything else to threaten their existence.
Perfectly said. Perfectly said. That is absolutely true. And, you know, we do vaccinate monk seals for a different virus. We don't have great options at the moment to be able to protect them through vaccination for avian influenza, but there has been a program that is really admirable to protect the California condor with vaccination, and that's in a specific geographic region, but we're looking really closely at that as well. And so we've at least got a tried and true way that we know we can give monk seals vaccines, and we have a process now for figuring out how to do that. So it's going to be an area where we're looking to do really everything we can, because like you said, so many resources and hard field time and hard work and, you know, community input and lots of things have gone into the positive signs that we've been seeing over the last 10 years for the Hawaiian monk seal. And we really want to do everything we can to bolster them and keep that going.
All right. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Michelle Barbieri of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She was talking to us about efforts to monitor our endangered monk seals for signs of avian flu. Well, it isn't every day that a magazine called The Atlantic gives considerable space to a story from the Pacific. Its author is Adrienne LaFrance. If her name is familiar to you, she used to work here at HPR and also at Honolulu Civil Beat. Originally from the East Coast, she has been with The Atlantic magazine for the last decade. She has penned an article about Hawaiian sovereignty with the headline, "What Happens When You Lose Your Country?" We talked to her about why she felt it was important to pen this perspective about the overthrow of the monarchy and political self-determination at this point in time.
When I first moved to Hawaii, I felt really shocked that I didn't know this history. So for years and years and years, just felt like more people should know. And, you know, I've been at The Atlantic magazine for more than 10 years now, and it had always been one of these stories that I felt like Atlantic readers deserved to have a deep sort of study of this chapter in history. And so that was the motivation. I had been thinking about it forever, and it felt really important and urgent to me. And I also felt like something that a lot of people just, if maybe don't accept in terms of accepting that it was from a value judgment standpoint, I guess, but like, I think a lot of people are sort of just like, well, it's history. It happens. Let's all move on. And that doesn't feel like the right reaction to me either. And so it feels like something worthy of serious study and contemplation.
What effect did the elections have on the timing of this article?
It didn't really. I mean, the one thing, so without getting too bogged down in the mechanics of the making of print magazines, but, you know, this story appears in our print magazine in addition to being online, of course. And so eventually you have to ship it off to the printer. And so we did deliberately wait until, you know, we were sort of like, well, we knew we'd have to ship the story off to the printer within days of the election. And so it was like, well, if we do know that there's a decisive outcome, if we know the outcome of the election, then there were a couple of details that I wanted to add, a couple of quotes that were more salient given that Trump won. And so we made sure to update it before shipping it since we knew the outcome of the election. But there is this current throughout the story where a lot of the people I spoke with talked about how the potential for destabilization of the United States affects the way they think about Hawaiian independence. And so that is a theme that kind of runs through the piece.
And so share with our listeners who you talk to for this story.
So I spent probably almost 2 years reporting this, which is a long time. And that's in part because I would do it in big chunks of time. And I, of course, wanted to be in Hawaii for part of it. So all in all, probably spoke to like 40 people. I mean, I did a lot of reporting for it. You know, I don't name everyone I interviewed in the piece or it would be way too long. But I spoke to a variety of people who have thought deeply about questions related to Hawaiian self-determination over many years. And so that includes activists, journalists, lawmakers like Senator Schott, former lawmakers like former Governor Waihe'e. And so I really wanted to get at both the history and the real range of opinions and approaches when it comes to this question of what America owes Hawaii and the Hawaiian people.
You start out the piece talking to Dennis Kanahele, who has the Pu'uhonua village over there in Waimanalo. Why did you think it was important to see it through his eyes?
People may know him as Bumpy Kanahele. I'd never met him before and was always interested in his activism. And I thought it was a interesting and powerful scene as well. Like when you think about how you can kind of bring the reader along with you and make them invested and interested. And what Bumpy and his colleagues are doing is really interpreting taking the apology, you know, the apology of 1993 and really interpreting that and sort of trying to advance their cause, not just theoretically or academically, but in how they're choosing to live on this land. And it's certainly one, if you think about sort of the ideas about Hawaiian sovereignty along a spectrum, it represents one key worldview. And then, of course, there are others. And so it seemed important to me to represent that way of thinking about things.
And then how do you square the attempts by self-proclaimed Kingdom of Hawaii people? You know, we've had groups try and take over the palace or take over the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. You know, I mean, not everybody agrees within the Hawaiian community about what needs to be done. I mean, in your article, you know, you talk to Kohio Lewis, and he's done great things, you know, in the past few years to really strengthen the perspective of the Native people here. But yeah, so how do you square the fact that not everybody agrees with what should happen going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually like one of the key points of the article is that, and one of the key
ways of trying to understand what happened and what is happening is there is no consensus. And, you know, I don't think it would be fair to expect consensus from a group of 600,000 plus people, right? And so to me, the approach is like try to understand the various different ways of thinking about it. And then you're finding through that, like people who want to totally restore Hawaiian independence and extricate Hawaii from the United States. You have people who, like Kuhio Lewis and others, who would argue that the best path toward good outcomes for the Hawaiian people is by working with the United States. You have people who are somewhere in between. You have people who don't want to engage with this topic at all. And so it's, I think there's a ton of complexity here. And, you know, I think sometimes people dismiss it by saying, well, I don't want a monarchy back, and so therefore this question is settled, or pick your other way of thinking about it. And in fact, the way that the people who have been thinking most deeply about this see it requires considerable nuance. And so my hope was to bring some of that forward as well.
Yeah, I mean, you say in your article that really this is not a story of Hawaii, it's a story of America, that nothing stays the same, nothing is permanent.
Right, and I have thought for so long about sort of like, well, how do you even attempt to right a historic wrong of this magnitude that happened so long ago? It's sort of like, how do you even begin to think about it? And one way for me of, you know, just really putting this into context, because for so long I thought about this as like this really important chapter in Hawaii's history, which of course it is. But what I don't think people widely understand is how important the overthrow was as a chapter in American history and defining what people understand about what America is and should be. And so that was another thing that I felt was really important to get across to our readers, that this isn't just about Hawaii and what happened to Hawaii, but it's about America and sort of the concept of what the nation is even for or should be.
Well, you know, there was a recent exhibit there in the nation's capital, you know, Visions and Revisions of U.S. Imperialism. And so that really laid out on the table the impact of that splendid little war had on so many people, from Puerto Rico to Cuba to Hawaii to Guam, just a really pivotal time in political history.
Right. It's interesting because I think sometimes the imperialism is treated as inevitable because it's what happened. But to me, one of the most interesting and revelatory parts of my reporting was really looking back at the congressional and presidential history at the time in the United States and looking at how there was this just extremely contentious, very public debate, including, by the way, playing out in the pages of the Atlantic magazine at the time. You know, our magazine's 167 years old. And so we were part of this debate ourselves. And you had people arguing like, you know, should America extend its borders beyond its shores or not? And ultimately it chose to, but not without considerable debate. And also not without considerable debate even after the overthrow. You know, the 5 years between the overthrow and annexation, there was a lot of debate and it was not treated as something that would stick. So that was just a big part of it that seemed important to me to contextualize for people who may not know this history deeply.
Well, I think people might appreciate the fact that you have put this perspective out there because sometimes, you know, the lens from the East Coast looking across the continent and across the Pacific is a little distorted.
Right.
But, you know, it's certainly a conversation to have. And some might see this as a opportunity to, you know, seize the day with the political overtones and the political landscape of the way it is today. But was there anything surprising to you as you dug deeper? What was the takeaway for you?
You know, a couple of things were surprising. I think one is just sort of how this has ebbed and flowed. Like when I last lived in Hawaii was during, you know, around the time when people were still debating the Akaka Bill, which many of your listeners will know, but was a bill that put forth the idea of federal recognition, sort of which would treat Hawaiians as similar to the way that the federal government has a relationship with American Indian tribes. And so it surprised me a little bit that so many of the people I interviewed for this story said that a lot of the momentum had sort of fizzled away after that point. And of course, you had really, I think you saw a moment or sort of a burst of activism around TMT. And there have been other moves or sort of discussions, productive discussions about self-determination and independence. But I guess, yeah, I mean, it was a little surprising to me that maybe not more had happened, I guess is how I would put it, in the past decade or so. And, you know, another thing that I think about a lot is sort of, while there's a lot more awareness, I think, like empirically, you can see that there's more conversation taking place across social media and just more awareness generally of this history than there was even a decade or two decades ago. There is this question for me of like, what does awareness get you? And how sort of how patient do you have to be between the point at which people understand history and can redress historic wrongs? And so that was one sort of surprise. And then I guess the other thing I would point out that wasn't as much of a surprise, but was a real genuine reporting challenge, was just there are such divergent views, and just sort of trying to piece together, like, to anyone who's thinking deeply about this issue, people are coming from very different places. And so trying to contextualize what's true, what's possible, is very difficult when you're looking at more than a century since the overthrow. And so it's just, the way I would say it is just like the history is extremely complicated. And, you know, there's that saying about like, the victors write the history. So even piecing together, like looking over historic documents and trying to understand what was true, I mean, it took a lot of time and effort. Was just a reminder of how hard it is to get to the truth over time.
Well, it certainly makes for interesting reading, but thank you so much, Adrienne, for your work and for starting this conversation out there.
Thank you for having me.
That was Adrienne LaFrance, executive editor of the news magazine The Atlantic. We'll share links on the story on our conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Cirque du Soleil show Oana debuted last week to its first paying customers. The name means Circus of the Sun, and the co-founder of the Cirque brand has said he was inspired in part by the beauty of Hawaii. This week, we've been re-airing our interviews with the creative professionals behind the scenes. Hawaii fashion designer Manaola Yap is returning to his roots as the show's costume designer. He says it was when he saw a ring around the moon, a moonbow, one night at his home on the Big Island. He took it as a sign about being a part of this artistic endeavor.
Well, you know, watching the snippet of the show, this little preview that we got, just to see the fabrics, the flowing fabrics and the designs, you know, which people associate with you, you know, but it's just really something to see it, you know, so big.
Yeah, no, I think I was definitely taken back the first time I saw everything, right, from the stage design, the set design, the costumes, and seeing all the artwork being embedded in different ways, you know, that was quite a shock, of course, you know, because the extent of my creations that I normally get to see is usually, you know, on the runway or, you know, in a storefront, but to see it, you know, moving across the stage and now not just moving across the stage, but in the air, you know, around in the acrobats, and you know, it's just, it's definitely a dream come true to just see it, and even more so a dream that I never had imagined, that our indigenous Hawaiian art would be, you know, elevated on a platform like this with Cirque du Soleil to celebrate our stories of Hawaii in that way. So it's definitely been an enriching experience.
Well, you are about flowy movement, you know, the energy, I think, that you bring to the designs, you know, whether, you know, we're wearing it or, but to see it on stage, it is pretty impressive. Do you have a favorite scene or any favorites in the show?
It's hard, you know, between me and Hiva, you know, bouncing ideas back and forth on what part we think is our favorite. It's really hard because we've come so intimately involved in all the pieces of the show, you know, even on a personal level, you know, getting involved with the storytelling. And I think if I had to choose one of my most favorite scenes, I would have to say it's probably Hina, just because of, you know, the moonscape pulls you into, you know, the night sky, but it just the environment that we're able to transcend and go into another space in that scene and really just dream, and that dream state is truly alive in that Hina scene. but everything from the costuming to the, not just the acrobatic costuming, but even like other performance costumes, like the skirt that shows the movements and the gravitational pull between the moon and the tides, and seeing that come to life with the movement of the acrobat and the lyra is just sensational.
You know, I have talked to people who have been up to your home, you know, up on the Mauna, and they just describe how special it is, how spiritual it is, and you draw from that inspiration.
Absolutely. You know, I think as artists, we come from a place of inspiration, right? We receive inspiration, we internalize it, and then we express it again, right, through our compositions, whether it's, you know, songs or artwork, painting, fashion, whatever it may be. But really, it's important for us to always have a sense of place and a sense of grounding. And that truly is our home, you know? And I think that every time I go back home, it's almost like returning to a spring, you know, that rush of energy of just being able to drink from it and to be nourished and to just feel that vitality every time I go home is important. And it transcends beyond us, right, in our artwork. And you see it push through in many pieces and parts of our arts.
And that was designer Mauna Ola talking about the Mauna, the spirit of the Cirque du Soleil show Awana, which opened to its first paying customers last week. Its red carpet debut is set for December 17th. The show is to run Wednesday through Sunday with two performances each night. We'll have more to come from our conversation with him right after a break. Let's continue with our conversation with Hawaiian fashion designer Mauna Ola Yap, who worked on the Awana costumes for the latest Cirque du Soleil show in Waikiki. He shares that sense of place was front of mind in his design concepts. You know, after living here for so long, I mean, I used to say, oh, I hate Waikiki, but I love Waikiki. And being able to walk through here and seeing it, you know, before the pandemic and during the pandemic and post-pandemic, you know, there's just something really special about Waikiki. And so the scene that, you know, the one segment, Hawaii Calls, and, you know, it is what it is today, but you just know there's really something special here at the core of Waikiki.
Absolutely. You know, when that scene was brought into the spectrum, it was important for us to honor that time period of that first interaction. You know, we touch on a lot of voyaging in the beginning, which, you know, you'll get to see when you see the whole show, but voyaging in different time periods, right? And the experience of what people were having, you know, when they arrived here. But what's really neat in that scene is the fact that a big part, like Kumu Hiva Vaughn has really elaborated on, is really the bringing back and restoring of light to this place that is Waikiki. You know, Waikiki has definitely seen many years of change, you know, not all good. But in that scene, we've really, you know, through Keao's hakumele, his lyrics, the costume design, and the hula, we have embedded a lot of beautiful poetry and kauna that speaks to the idea of Waikiki being a place of rest, rejuvenation, and although, you know, the visual scene of what Waikiki is today has definitely been, you know, developed in a very robust way, we still have to come here and really celebrate the land for what it is. And I think opportunities like this Cirque du Soleil show, where there's storytelling involved through the hula, through the mele, there's definitely a beautiful aloha, a beautiful reciprocal exchange that happens in a spiritual way, in a deeper way, in a meaningful way through the storytelling that really allows us to restore our native voice and help to really rewrite the narrative of this place in a good way and in an exciting and inspiring way.
And I think in an authentic way, right? Absolutely. You want that mana, the spirit, to really come through.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We've seen so many different takes on Waikiki. And so I think, and we hope that the audience sees the heart that comes through.
Absolutely. You know, everything that we've done in this show, we really have concentrated. Keao actually speaks really well to the fact that as a cultural team, we really designed this show to tell the stories how we would tell it. Because we already knew that in the, you know, in the commercial side of it and the tourism side, which is where we're going to really make a lot of change because we're going to inspire a lot of people that sit in these seats, is the fact that we have to write it from our perspective and tell the story how we would. Because through the lens of Cirque du Soleil, no matter what we do or present, it's going to transcend to everyone in a way, because it's done on the level of Cirque du Soleil. You know, so the tourists, you know, all the our Malihini that are coming, our visitors that are going to come to experience the show, are really going to be captivated and touched. So really, this is our chance to tell it in a way that we want to tell it and share with them in that space that really is the authenticity that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's the true by and about. But maybe, I don't know, you think then the locals here will be your toughest critics?
You know, I think our locals, if they really listen and hear the intention of what we have implemented and really the spirit of what Cirque du Soleil is all about. Really, Cirque du Soleil, which is the circus of the sun, is really about, it's very Hawaiian actually at heart, because when you look at the sun, for us, the sun really is a point of energy and mana, of great mana and power, but also a point of inspiration. And really, that's what all these amazing acts that come from all around the world, these amazing, talented artists, singers, acrobats, dancers, bring to the stage, is really to bring a point of inspiration to all those who are touched by the DNA of these shows and productions. And through the telling of our Hawaiian stories, I think, if our kama'aina are really listening to the words, or they're able to hear all of the beautiful mana'o, all the beautiful ike that we have embedded, that experiential knowledge from our, you know, the ike kupuna from our ancestors, to really just the amount of amazing collaboration that we've had between even opening up our home that is Hawaii through that spirit of aloha and bringing in these artisans from around the world and having them, you know, inviting them to be, you know, almost like hanaiing them, right? That idea of bringing them into our family to learn, because they're telling our stories, right? And the only way for them to tell our stories in this platform and for all of this to be successful is we have to open up. We have to allow them the space to work, you know, bring their magic of their talents and our stories of who we are and where we're from, and fuse that together in a beautiful way. And I hope that, I definitely know that I have felt it through this process, that our kama'aina also are touched and feel their heart as well, because each and every single one of them have very deep reverence for our home here in Hawaii, and have really done everything that they can to, you know, they want to do the best. They want to portray the characters as best as they can.
And that was designer Mana Ola Yap talking about the mana, the spirit of the show Awana, which has taken a residence at the newly renovated showroom at the Outrigger Beachcomber Hotel in Waikiki. And that does it for us. We're out of time today. I'm Catherine Cruz.